Good evening. My name is Jeff. I'm an alcoholic. Jeff. Delighted to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Delighted to be sober. Really happy to be alive and anywhere. And I want to thank Troy for extending the privilege to speak in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I used to hear people say that, oh, it's a privilege to speak in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it truly is. And I also read it. It's in the doctor's opinion. The doctor says that Bill came to Dr. Silkworth and asked for the privilege to be able to carry this message to other people. And with some misgiving, he allowed him to do that. And I suppose that's why we're here today, is because Dr. Silkworth said, yeah, you can carry what you know. At that time, they didn't really have the 12 steps when Alcoholics Anonymous wasn't even Alcoholics Anonymous. But so he carried this message, and nobody stayed sober for a while, for a long time, 6 months or longer. He finally met up with Dr. Bob, which happened to be Mother's Day in 1935, and they met, and Dr. Bob said it was the first time anybody knew how he felt, and it was the first time he ever found another man on the face of the earth that knew how he drank and how he felt and the way he thought and the whole deal. And that was the spark to become Alcoholics Anonymous, and I suppose that's another reason we're here today. So I have a sobriety date. It's December 25th, 1990, and I hope and pray that I'm always willing to do whatever it takes to maintain that sobriety day. Other than right now, that's the most important day of my life. And I have a sponsor, Bob D. Many of you know him. He's in Las Vegas and a very, very active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have a home group, too, and it's the WE group. And it meets in San Diego on both Monday nights, and on Thursday night we have a speaker meeting, and Monday night we have a book study, and we actually study the book and the steps and all that stuff. And so if you're new, and there's a lot of new people here, I'd like to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. This is a very active group, and it's based on, Alcoholics Anonymous. You couldn't hit the jackpot any better than being in this meeting now. So my hope is that you come back to this group and go to as many meetings as possible. And just for fun here, I don't know if you guys do this at any time during the meeting, but how many people in here are willing to sponsor new people? So keep your hands up for a minute. There's a lot of new people here, so it's kind of a weird thing. You come to AA and you don't know who's a sponsor, who's not a sponsor, who's been through the program, who understands it, who, can get you in the literature, and hopefully you'll have some kind of a spiritual awakening or a change of attitude that will allow you to stay in Alcoholics Anonymous. I used to drink. I guess that's a prerequisite for being in AA. And it's always good to mention that, I believe. It is a program of identification. And for me, it was, I was 12 years old, and it was me and my buddies. We got together, and we got some Red Mountain wine, or Paisano, one of those, and we drank it. And for me, it was electric. I mean, it was just wonderful. And I remember having that thought at 12 years old, that if alcohol makes you feel this good, why don't people drink all the time? And not everybody has that sensation that drinks alcohol. But for me, it was like, this is it. I was a pretty cute little kid, but I just couldn't see myself going to my parents to tell them, I've just found the secret of life, and I really think we should keep some cheap red wine in the refrigerator. I just knew I wasn't that cute, So I began to do the things that little kids do, and they get together with the other little juvenile delinquents, and they steal booze from their parents, and they mix it all together, and they drink it, and, just get violently ill and can't wait to do it again. And so the first time I was the first time I was to hear the words Alcoholics Anonymous in conjunction with my name was 1968. It makes me old. And me and my buddies got together, and four of us, we chugged a quart of Jim Beam. In just like 5 minutes, we got this Jim Beam and we just chugged it. And we were like, nothing was happening, I was waiting for the pop, So I saw some aftershave lotion in the bathroom, and we were going to go hang out at the football field. So I took a few pulls off the aftershave lotion, and off to the football field we went. And it just hit us. I didn't know there was a time delay with alcohol, and we got really sick. And My buddies got, you know, we got kicked out of high school and went to see the counselor, and the counselor told my parents, they said, well, either he should go to continuation school, or maybe if you want to stay in regular school, he should go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, that was 1968, and I was a freshman in high school. Alcoholics Anonymous wasn't prevalent for young people like it is today. And, you know, so I didn't go, long and short of it. So I got busy drinking and doing all those things, and I started practicing, you know, the third chapter of Alcoholics Anonymous on the night that I got reunited and went readmitted back into high school. I said I would never drink again. Trust me, if you drink after shave lotion and Jim Beam, you will never want to drink again. You will never drink after shave lotion again, I assure you that. That's a one-shot deal. But so 6 months later, to the night, I was readmitted back into high school, and my buddies were still drinking 190, 191, and 152, or 150, 151, 192, whatever that stuff is, it was rot gut. And I switched to natural wines, and I switched to, you know, some softer things. And so I was doing the dance that we all do in Alcoholics Anonymous. Somehow it's going to be different this time. I'm going to mix just the right things. You know, I'm not going to drink too much, whatever it is. And I discovered that hard liquor was really a problem for me. So I did the obvious thing, and I switched to beer and natural wines. Now, I was astonished at how much, at a young age, how much beer you can drink if you're an alcoholic. I don't know. You know, they used to talk about having a hollow leg, and now I get it, because I can sit down and I can drink a 12-pack of beer. I can drink a case of beer. Now, that's abnormal. You know, social drinkers don't do that stuff. They say stuff like, oh, I've had two, I'm starting to feel full, you know, or I'm starting to get a glow, or come on, let's go. Give it all up, you know. And so that's kind of the way it was. And I met a little gal, and I was to start getting in a lot of trouble in high school. And, you know, the reality was that I just couldn't wait to get out of there. You know, I've always wanted to grow up quicker than I was. I wanted to be 21. I wanted to be able to go to the bars. I wanted to drink like a gentleman. I've always wanted to do that since I was, you know, 12, 13, 14 years old. I just want to be able to sit down with a bottle of anything and just go, whew, you know, just be that way with no parents and no school and all that. So I didn't go back my senior year of high school. I showed them, and had a resentment against the high school football coach. And, you know, I ended up getting married at a young age to a little gal. And, you know, we started this dance of death that we do here. I had no business getting married. You know, she had no business getting married. You know, it was just kind of like two crazy people getting together under the auspices of love. And anyhow, a few years later, my daughter Sarah was born. And that was truly a beautiful thing. And I said the thing that, you know, parents often say is, I'm going to be a wonderful father. I'm going to be a good provider. I'm going to be a friend. I'm going to do all the things that parents do. And my parents were great examples of how to be parents. And somehow, you know, I got this fault-finding malcontent, this brain that I can find fault with anybody, but I'm going to do it better, and I'm going to do it different. So Sarah was born, and you know, I started doing the things that young alcoholic men do. You know, and I go out for a pack of cigarettes, and I don't come home for 2 or 3 days. Guess what? My wife misses me. You know, so you know, she lost her sense of humor, So after a while, that marriage was dissolved, and I came home, and my stuff's out on the porch, and, you know, a suicide attempt, and all the stuff we do, you know, all the crazy stuff out there, because I couldn't stand the notion of not being able to see my daughter on a regular basis. And there was something inside me, and I didn't know what it was until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, but there's something inside of me that's just clearly not right, and I don't know what it is, because I don't seem to be able to have, you know, I've lacked the ability to go to work and work like 5 consecutive days, week in and week out, and bring home the paycheck and pay the bills and do, I mean, it's just too much pressure for me. I can't take it. And I don't seem to be able to get along with people. And if I'm at work, I was in the building trades, and if we disagree, and you disagree more than once with me, I hit you, you know, and I get fired for violence. And so I got no skills for communication. I'm a violent guy, kind of, but I want to be a good guy, but I just don't seem to be able to get it. And I don't understand how people get along in life, you know? So It was just crazy. And I have two older brothers and a younger sister, and they're not alcoholics. I've seen them drink. They don't have this thing that happens to them. Maybe at certain times in their lives they've drank hard for whatever reason, but responsibilities, having kids, doing the things that we do, they just kind of scale it back and behave. They know how to do that. I don't know how to do that. So I'm bouncing around the trades, and the divorce is final, and I'm absolutely crazy. And my oldest brother is a very successful attorney. And when you're growing up and you're a high school dropout, your brother is like meeting governors and, you know, meeting presidents, and he's, you know, you just start to hate him, you know. It's just like, man, he was so successful. Everything he touched turned to gold, and I can't do anything. But he never stopped loving me through the whole process. So we're out there, and one day we're riding horses out in Wickenburg, Arizona. It was a big organized horseback ride, and we're, you know, drunk. Oh, it was a big drunk fest. And he says to me, he says, you know, Jeff, I've seen you struggling, and you know, we just bought some radio stations, and how would you like to get into the radio business? And I said, I would love to get into the radio business. You know, I would. You could probably tell I have executive potential, but... so... I do. I have executive potential. I just need one shot. You know, I need the big shot. So, you know, he said, well, I'll hook you up with some people, and, you know, you've got to straighten up. You've got to fly right. You've got to be good with these people. I mean, these are radio professionals. They have degrees in marketing. They have degrees in communications. These are sharp people. And I just feel like a klutz. I feel like a dummy. But I tell you what, I've got that alcoholic... I'll dig my heels in and do it, man, because this is my shot. You know, don't get in my way, because we got problems if you do. You know, so I'm taking this kind of a junkyard dog mentality into the radio business. But I'm trying to polish it up a little bit, because I'm trying to behave. You know, I'm trying to do that deal. So I show up, and, you know, there's some success mixed in with it. And, you know, I sold the largest electronic media advertising campaign ever in Yuma, Arizona. So the success was relative to... But I was a big shot in Yuma. I mean, you know, I don't think there's another person in here that can claim that. But so I'm having a lot of fun. I'm doing the things, and, you know, I'm having fun. I'm doing it, and, you know, I met my landlady. She was ended up being my girlfriend. I said, you know, because rent is going to get a little dicey here at some point in time. So, you know, I got to kind of move to the mothership. So, you know, I hit on her, and she became my girlfriend. We'll just call her the nudist from here on out. But her and her friends like to take off their clothes a lot and all that stuff. But I don't want to get into all that stuff. But that was a lot of fun, actually. But so I'm selling a lot of advertising down there, and I'm having a good time. But I'm drinking. I'm going out in a three-piece suit, and I'm working all day, and then I'm going home and partying with the bikers at night. And I started out, and I was living on a golf course, and, you know, 6 months later, I'm living in a small trailer in between lettuce fields, and I'm dying of alcoholism, and I don't even know it, and I'm lonely. You know, our book talks about loneliness that few can ever realize until you know how lonely it is to be, and nobody knows how you feel. Nobody, you know, you can't really communicate, and I'm months behind in my rent, and my girlfriend's not happy with me, and... I go into the radio station one day, and there were some people there from a treatment center. And they gave me the account. They said, meet with these people. So I went and met with them, and it was my job as a radio executive to find out more about their business. So I said, well, what do you treat? And they said, well, we work with people with drug and alcohol problems. And I thought, well, that's fascinating. You know, I made no eye contact the rest of the little interview. So it was my job to find out more about the business, so I wrote this stuff down, and I said, okay, I'll call you back later today. My job to write the commercials. So I called him back later that day, and I said, this is what I got. It says, I feel helpless, and I feel hopeless, and my wife divorced me, and I can't keep a job, and I can't stop drinking. And they said, that's perfect. Yeah. And so, you know, it's kind of like a little mini first step, I suppose. And so I'm driving down the street, and I've been, like, overcompensating for my blackouts for several days. And I'm driving down the street, and I hear my voice. Somebody suggested that I record it. So I recorded it. Never done any recording before. So I'm driving down the street, and it's, you know, midnight, 1 a.m, and my voice comes out all over Yuma Valley. It says, I feel helpless, and I feel hopeless, and my wife divorced me, and I can't keep a job and I can't stop drinking. And I went, oh, Jesus, now everybody knows. And it was, you know, how often do you do that? I mean, you know, it was, you know, I had a bed in that same treatment center within a few days. And so somehow through the universe here, I 12-stepped myself into this little treatment center. And the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous happened for me in there. And when I say the miracle is I'm running around the face of the earth and I don't know, you know, the friends are gone, the working relationships are strained, you know, the radio station fired me from all the stuff I was doing and they didn't even know half of it. And I go into this treatment facility and there's a psychologist or a psychiatrist on board. There are no other alcoholics on staff, none. There's people that have other disorders that are evident, but there's no other alcoholics in there. So there's no identification. And then one night on a Saturday night, a guy from Alcoholics Anonymous came in, and he came in all by himself. He was part of the Hospitals and Institutions Committee. And I'm glad he came in by himself. Rather, if he didn't come in with a partner, who knows? If I wouldn't have got the message that night, maybe I wouldn't be here today. Now, that was 1987, and he came in and carried the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. I sat next to the guy, read those magnificent words, how it works for the first time. You know, rarely have we seen a person fail who's thoroughly followed a path. People who cannot recover cannot completely give themselves to this simple program. You know, so we read that, and the message had depth and weight, and this guy told a story, and it's the first time, much like Dr. Bob, it was the first time I'd ever heard anybody tell my story. You know, this guy knew how I thought, he knew how I drank, he knew how I felt, and it was magnetic. I just went, wow, this is amazing. Now, I know a lot of four-letter words, but help isn't one of them, you know, and I can't just like go up to this guy and say, okay, you got me, what do I do? Help me, you know. There was some other stuff that had to happen. That's what my brain was saying, talk to the guy, ask him for help, ask him for help. And, you know, took no action, and the opportunity just vaporized. So it was my first connection with another sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and a few days later, I was dismissed. You know, I left that treatment center, been in there 10 days, went out with my girlfriend and to dinner, and we sat down, and I ordered Pepsi. And she says, well, Jeff, you know, beer's never been a problem for you. You're ordering Pepsi. And I said, well, I just spent 10 days in this little treatment center, and I got a pretty good idea I'm not supposed to drink. And she said, well, beer's never been a problem for you. You know, it's all the other stuff. And I said, you know, you're right. Beer has never... She's very perceptive. I said, you know, what could one beer hurt? Right? What could one beer hurt? I have a profound respect for the first drink. So I took the one drink. Now, that was 1987, and my sobriety date is the very end of December. It's December, you know, Christmas Day, 1990. That's 4 years of pain and agony just from taking that one beer. You know, that's not that price. I don't want to ever have to pay that price again. I don't ever want to be able to not see my daughter for 4+ years. I don't want to ever live in that pain and loneliness, just, you know, how we get when we're just out there. So if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, stay with us. You know, you don't have to go down any further, which is a beautiful thing. So when I came back, you know, I took a drink, and the drink took a drink, and there it is, you know. And I was in Yuma, and I ended up back in San Diego and got arrested a few times. I don't arrest well. I jail even worse. You know, I'm not a happy guy to be there. And it was the San Diego County felony tank, and it was a pretty rough place, you know. And starting to do some soul searching there and just realizing my life is an absolute disaster. You know, there's my dear sweet mother, you know, I kept ending up in my parents' house. I don't know, has anybody ever had to like move back into mom and dad's house on multiple occasions? You know, I'm just like back at the house. Between that and living outside, you know, I didn't know I was homeless for a while, but you know, I was living on the lake, and I didn't know that was homelessness till I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Hell, it's a nice, tidier package. But you know, I was living back in my parents' house, and I get these bills every month, and my mother just keeps stuffing them into a pillowcase. And I haven't seen my daughter in years, and I had a son through a different relationship, and I hadn't seen him since he was an infant, and I didn't want to claim responsibility for him. And I feel absolutely like I'm a failure as a parent, and there's no feeling about it. It was the absolute truth. I failed as a parent. I was a failure as a husband, as a brother, as a son. My parents would give me that look of pity. They'd just go, it was painful, really painful stuff. So somewhere in there, I remembered about going to meetings. Boom. I was watching a movie, Dead Poets Society, and they talked about carpe diem in there, seize the day. And I'm sitting here dying on my dad's couch, and I'm physically sober. I am physically sober, and I'm detoxing on my dad's couch, and I'm crying like a baby. Because physically sober, I cannot stand the person that I have become. Just crying like a baby, just bawling. My parents would come out, "Are you okay?" And I go, "Yeah, I'm fine. And so I started going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I started to see people that were living in the solution. The people that had the spiritual awakening and the change of attitude, they seemed to enjoy life, man, and I'm just hating life. And they also were practicing the traditions, and, they were making people feel welcome. It was a safe place to come. Come on in. We're glad you're here. Have a cup of coffee. Have some cookies. We're glad you're here. Don't leave until the miracle happens. And I'm going to that, and I'm going to the meeting. I'm getting swept up in it, and the people are talking about it. Now, the problem is that I'm absolutely insane, and I don't know what the problem is. The problem, I didn't know it was selfishness and self-centeredness. I didn't know that I was so self-absorbed that I couldn't even focus on anybody else. It took a sponsor a while for me to get into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous before I started to know what the solution was. So I was enraptured by the people that had come here, and they were living this deal, and I started to kind of follow them around, and some things happened. I met some good people, some solid people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I finally ended up with a good sponsor. I was talking with Dave about it earlier. He knows my first sponsor, Barney Morris. Dave got sober there in San Diego or Orange County, Southern California, and Barney didn't care how I felt, and he really didn't care what I thought about anything. And he was a big guy. He was 6'3". He was an ex-anchor man, and he could give this talk and fill the room without a microphone. And Barney he goes, "I don't care how you feel. I really don't care what you think, Jeff. I care what you do." And he showed me how to get involved in a home group. And by his example, and that's what we are, I suppose, we're examples of what to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. Through his living example, getting involved in a home group, I started to feel like I was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Took some inventory, started to realize what the problem was, started to be able to make some of those amends. At 6 months of sobriety, I was reunited with my little girl, Sarah, and she'd gone from being a little girl into a young woman, and I wasn't there for it, and there's a long period of reconstruction ahead. And so we've been trying to rebuild that relationship for a while. So I got active in a home group as La Jolla Speakers, and I started feeling a part of, and started to make the inventory, finally moved out of my parents' house again, and got a little place, and went to work after a while for this little coffee company, and just about then, I was probably about 5 years sober, and I was active with this home group, sponsoring a bunch of guys, about 12 guys, starting to feel like I was part of this thing. This company asked me to move to Northern California. And nothing like a new job and moving and stuff to make alcoholics absolutely insane. But, I wasn't suffering from long-term employment before or prosperity when I came to you. So I went to my sponsor, Barney, and his sponsor, Johnny H., and we talked about it. And they said, "Yeah, take a risk, kid. Make the move." So moved to Northern California. Just prior to that, I met my lovely bride, Anita. And I was in a meeting, and, I told her I was moving to Northern California, and she couldn't take her eyes off of me. Okay, well, anyhow, we both had an affinity for each other. And so we started dating, and And we dated long distance for a while, and she moved up, and she brought her sons with her, and one son, and then after a while, the other son moved in. And I got to tell you guys, you want to hear the story. Hear the story, you know, if you're going to date somebody, or guys or gals, this is reversible. So Anita's got the boys, we're living at the house, and I hear Anita's story for the first time, and I think, oh my God, I've got Ma Barker and the Menendez boys living in my house, but she's changed a lot. And So we had a hell of a ride up in there in Northern California, and we got very active up there, and the coffee pot's on, and our doors are always open to members of Alcoholics Anonymous to come on in. We had the great privilege of sponsoring a lot of people and being very active in Northern California. A few months after we got married, Anita and I bought our first little condominium overlooking the ocean in Pacifica, California. And that, I don't know how that happens to people like us. You know, we're both very, very, very low-bottom drunks. And for us to have anything that belongs to us was amazing. She ended up getting a great job and a profession working for a town early on for the city council and later on for the police chief. And then I ended up going to work for this company and still work with them up until a few months ago. And, you know, all I've done was practice Alcoholics Anonymous because I didn't come into you. I had no skills when I came to you guys. My skills were frustration, despair, and loneliness. And I came to you and just practiced the things that sponsors have taught me how to do. And through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, went to work as a project manager for this company, was the first senior project manager in the Western United States, promoted in charge of construction and a team. You know, when I did the calculation, I spent between $50 to $60 million worth of this company's money over a 12-year career in project management. Prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I got pulled out of a recycling line for putting wax and sand into cans. You know, that's what came to you 18 years ago. So just kind of moving along through that process, Anita and I finally moved to the East Bay and you know, we bought a beautiful home there, and then, you know, we got hit by all the other stuff going on out there too that, you know, perhaps some of you in there got hit with. So some financial stuff, and the company I was with asked me if we wanted to move back to San Diego, so we just moved back a few months ago, and some things started to happen there. And I just want to say briefly that we blended our families together. Anita brought two beautiful boys into our relationship, and I brought Sarah and Ryan into the relationship. And this is God's truth, is the only way I learned how to be a father was by being a stepfather to Anita's boys. And as soon as I stopped treating those kids like stepkids, they started behaving, and I started behaving. And I really learned a lot of parenting. I mean, there's so much we can do as sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous to touch the community. And so our youngest son is sober 7 years in AA, soon to be 8 years. And these kids call me Pops, and my daughter calls me Daddy. She calls me Daddy when she really wants something. And, you know, I had the great privilege of walking her down the aisle a few years ago. And it was a magnificent day. You know, to walk my little baby girl, Sarah, down the aisle. And we just cried and danced. And, you know, I have Alcoholics Anonymous to thank for that entire thing. I have Alcoholics Anonymous to thank for my entire life. I mean, it's unbelievable what happens when you come in here and surrender to this thing. Just surrender. Just go, okay, what's next? What do I do next? Hey, sponsor, I need a sponsor. What do you want me to do, sponsor? You know, let's get in the book. Let's do whatever it takes. So we moved back to Southern California November 15th, and I go in and see Anita in the front room. She retired, you know, with honors. The police chief gave her a send-off, and police chiefs don't get emotional, and the police chief was emotional on that day. And then I'd come in and watch her, make sure Anita was comfortable and doing all this stuff, and then my company called me shortly thereafter on February 11th, and they said, you know, we've tried to keep you this long, a lot of layoffs. They said, you're going to retire on Friday the 13th. I'm thinking, oh boy, you know, and then I'm supposed to talk at a conference in Northern California on Friday the 13th, and so it's like twin back-to-back Friday the 13th. So We have a little party on Friday the 20th, and then on the 22nd, I wake up in the morning, and 60% of my vision is gone. I'd had a stroke that night in February, and I stand there, and I'm going, Jesus, you know, throw some water on my face, go, okay, nothing, you know. And, you know, somebody was talking earlier about, you know, what we do here at Alcoholics Anonymous to stay sober one day at a time. And, you know, I was freaked out, you know, for obvious reasons. And so Anita takes me to the hospital, and you know, I saw your faces. You know, I saw my sobriety brothers, Troy, and I saw Ben, and I got phone calls from these guys and from people all over the Western United States, you know, well-wishers and text messages and emails and phone calls. You know, where else do you get that kind of love? I don't know. But so as I got up from the gurney to the wheelchair, I noticed a little speck of dirt on the floor, and I said, hey, I can still hit a golf ball. This may not be all that bad after all, you know. I got Alcoholics Anonymous, I got a primary purpose, and I can still hit the golf ball. So my primary purpose, as with yours, the people that have been around here for a while, and that was that Tony had mentioned in his talk, my primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. And, you know, it's a beautiful way to live, man. It's amazing. I mean, where else can you go? I've moved in sobriety several times, and I have empathy for people that have to move, that don't plug in, don't have Alcoholics Anonymous or this fellowship to plug into. It's like, you know, all you do is show up at a meeting. Hey, I'm new to the area. I'm here. Is there something I can do to help? And, man, we will plug your ass in. Excuse me. That's all I... So I've been plugged in several times. We were plugged in back down in San Diego, and we're living a good life down there. You know, we have four grandchildren, and the grandchildren just love us. You know, we got little Tristan. We're not sure if he's going to be one of us or not. I'm not judging. I'm just saying. And then Morgan, and then... we got a couple other grandchildren that we brought into the family, and we're having a good time. You know, as we learn how to do things here in Alcoholics Anonymous, to give ourselves completely to this program, you know, it wasn't part of Anita's plan, and certainly wasn't part of my plan for her to have to drive me everywhere, you know, starting from a certain day on, but that's just been it. She got in the car, and we drove up here, spending time with my dear friend Ben and his wife Nyla, and you know, we were at the spring cleaning over the weekend. And where the hell were you? No, I'm kidding. It was a wonderful event. I tell you, it was great. Ralph W. was there, and my sponsor Bob D., and they took us through the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous and shared their experience, strength, and hope. And it's one of those weekends where it's like a life-changing experience. You know, it just wasn't like, let's get together and talk about it. It was a life-changing experience. So that's an extraordinary thing. If you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous or not so new, and you just kind of, you know, get involved with these things, do these things that we do. And I came out of there with so much more than I ever anticipated. So we're up here, and we're just kind of hanging out and doing some fishing and enjoying life. You know, I talked with Ben on the line, or he sent a text message. And correct me if I'm wrong when this is over here, because, you know, with a stroke, I'm claiming stroke, you know, some stroke survivor. If I'm grossly wrong with anything anymore, I'm a stroke survivor. But Ben sent me a little email, and he says, maybe you should, you know, consider part of your therapy coming up to Utah and doing a little fishing. And I said, you're right, you know. And so that's what we're here, you know. Like I say, you know, it was just like 2.5 weeks before I was supposed to talk at a conference in Northern California. And we keep our AA commitments. You know, that's what we do. I'm thinking here going, I don't know if I can do it, I don't. Apparently, it's just taken the vision part of my brain. But I'm thinking, oh, Jesus, well, I got to show up. I mean, Dr. Bob was dying of cancer, and he got up and did his address. And Bill W. was dying of, and not that I'm on the plane of these guys, but, you know, we've had tremendous examples. You know, One of the, you know, but after Barney Morris passed away, I had a sponsor named Glenn Loyster. And Glenn was a great example of Alcoholics Anonymous. He would load up in his car. He lived in Palm Desert, and he would drive to Northern California 6-7 hours to talk to sponsees about the traditions, and then he would drive home on his own dime. So we're talking 12, 14 hours, spend a night in a hotel just to talk to, you know, a dozen sponsees about the 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous and his talking history. And then 5 days before he passed away, he could barely walk. This guy had emphysema, and he would have to stop and breathe, you know, gather his lungs if he'd walk from that door over to the podium. And you have to stop for 10 minutes and talk. And this guy was given a talk somewhere, you know, 5 days before he passed away. And I just look at these guys' examples of what to do here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's, to me, it's astonishing what you've done. You guys have shown me through your living and dying examples that here in Alcoholics Anonymous, we have one primary purpose. It's to stay sober and carry this message to the alcoholic who still suffers. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous has absolutely changed my life. You know, to have these children in our lives today and to have a loving home, you know, the home we have is just absolutely gorgeous. You know, it's full of love. We ended up buying my parents' house and moved back to San Diego, and we're living in this beautiful little home overlooking the football field, built in 1960, hasn't been touched since 1960, but, you know, it's our home. And, you know, everywhere I go and everywhere I do, I think of you, and this would be another one of those, just a tremendous little footnote in our path in sobriety, is the people in Utah, in Salt Lake City, that came out to show us what life and love is all about. So, with that, I think I'm through, and I want to thank you for my life.